Well, hey, everybody. Thanks for joining me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson, on I Don't Care With, of course, me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. Always appreciate you joining me for healthcare topics that are relevant for today's discussion. And today's guest is going to be a lot of fun. It's not often that you get to interview somebody that you've known for well over 40 years. Dr. David Foster is a healthcare executive based in Little Rock, Arkansas. And I've known David for a long time. His older brother was a fraternity brother and roommate of mine at Baylor University. And so I remember David coming up to visit us. And fortunately, we didn't taint his growth too much because he's been incredibly successful. And anyway, David, welcome to I Don't Care.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Hard to believe it's been that long, huh?
Yeah, I was trying to remember. I think I was 15, 16-ish. I know I wasn't driving yet, so I don't know if my parents wouldn't let me drive, but it was right around that driving age, and yeah, it's been a minute.
Yeah, it really has. Well, David, you've obviously gone on to become incredibly successful in your private practice and your healthcare executive work, so... you spent decades serving patients and communities through Common Spirit in the Little Rock area and throughout Arkansas. So looking back, what accomplishments are you most proud of and what lessons have stayed with you throughout your career?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's, you know, I'd like to say there's so many, but it really just simply comes down to building and creating a patient panel. I've always believed that a physician's practice, and probably this extends to other providers as well, but obviously from my perspective, a physician's practice is very reflective of not only the community we serve, but the physician and the patients that make up that panel. And it really takes on a life of its own. And it's reflective of your personality. It's reflective of your professional and personal interests. Existing patients refer family and friends to you, and it really becomes a reflection of yourself. And I was particularly proud of the panel of patients that I curated, the trust we extended to one another, and partnerships that we developed as we looked to care for one another. I really do. I learned as much from that panel of patients as I think they learned from me. And that's something that I'm proudest of. And I feel like it's a unique reflection and maybe a gift that I helped provide to healthcare and certainly to the communities that I served was that panel of patients.
Yeah, that's great to hear because unfortunately a lot of physicians now, because of pressures in and around productivity or whatever, they've become so involved in the process of getting a patient through that they've at times forget about the patient itself. And so really glad that was something that you continue to focus on. So you've led organizations in periods of tremendous change in healthcare. So what changes fundamentally improved care delivery and which challenges really seem to persist no matter how much healthcare evolved?
Yeah. And maybe in spite of the evolution of healthcare, I think hands down from the clinical perspective, I think advances in clinical medicine, again, I've got a recency bias and certainly a bias having practiced for the last 30 years. But the advances that we've made in medicine are nothing short of phenomenal and certainly could not have been predicted when I started my career in 1997. I apologize if the statistics fail me at this moment, but I do recall a very poor prognosis for one diagnosed with breast cancer in 1997. I want to say it was on the order of 25-30% survival rates. And now that's much closer to 90%. And that's a fairly short time frame to take one of the leading cancer diagnoses, certainly for women, but even overall for a community or for a population, and to dramatically change the survivability of that. And that's just one example of many. You and I can tell so many other treatments that have advanced and progressed to create chronic diseases that are much more livable and even curable than they were just a short time ago. I think that's, again, maybe even a miracle approaching miracle status from my perspective. I think However, with all of the advances in modern healthcare, it really has also created challenges for physicians, particularly primary care physicians. But I think even specialists now are expected to know more about healthcare and healthcare delivery methods than even a few generations ago. A colleague of mine, his father was a specialty surgeon, and I don't think he was joking. He said when he went into medical school, his microbiology class, I think they had 100 organisms to study. And that was just two generations ago. And so that the level of complexity as we've advanced the science has really resulted in practicing clinicians being overwhelmed or potentially being overwhelmed. I don't want to speak for my peers, but I certainly had a sense of time at times being overwhelmed with all the options available to me and my patients. And so I think that's the opposite side of that coin. So the healthcare advancement has been a wonderful blessing, and it's also been created additional noise and confusion within healthcare.
No, I can relate to that. I recently had an emergency appendectomy where I was wheeled back to the OR at about 6 o'clock in the evening and was home by 10 o'clock. I mean, that was unheard of. You know, speaking with friends of mine about my experience, they were amazed because they said, you know, and I'm a little bit older than the typical appendectomy patient. But they said, you know, whenever they were younger, they remembered spending 3 and 4 days in the hospital. But I made it pretty clear to my surgeon, who was someone I knew well, I'm not spending the night in the hospital. So do what you need to do. And that lends me to a kind of a follow-up question. You know, you were talking about some of the challenges that have evolved in healthcare. Yeah, talk a little bit about the advent of the vast amount of information that patients can avail themselves of, you know, because, you know, obviously we've seen the funny commercials about Holiday Inn Express. I'm not a physician, but I stayed in Holiday Inn Express. And I'm sure you can confidently say a lot of your patients kind of had that attitude, right?
Absolutely. And the reality is, particularly from a primary care perspective, a lot of times patients will come in having done their homework and research. They will frequently teach me about something that I wasn't even aware of. I mean, the reality is medical school is available at your fingertips if you have access to a web. And if you have the passion and the interest, and a lot of my patients may not have gone to medical school, but they were certainly smart enough and passionate enough about their own diagnosis that they would do their due diligence and come in with some really good and reasonable suggestions at times. At other times, it's also as easy it is for a doctor to get distracted by all of the availability. Maybe it's at least as easy and maybe easier for a non-clinician, a non-clinically trained individual to get distracted by the available options. And so sometimes you'd spend a lot of time helping them learn from a mistake or a misconception they have from their hours of passionate research on a subject that obviously is more personal to them than it was to me. So it was a balancing act. It's a blessing and a curse. All of the information is available. You just need to take time to listen and then go with what works for both you and the patients, informed consent, informed decision-making. But sometimes not talk them out, but sometimes when you had to inform them further about why maybe a different option is in their better interest, that could be frustrating at times and challenging.
Sure. I can only imagine. So you were part of Common Spirit there in Little Rock, and it has a very strong faith-based mission. I know because I was with CHI years ago, one of the founding organizations of Common Spirit. So how did that mission shape your leadership philosophy and the culture you sought to build throughout your career?
Well, it's a great question. And this is something I'm passionate about. And I talk to my peers and colleagues all the time. You know, we're blessed to work for these organizations. We truly are. While I pray and hope that all of our peers and colleagues get to have exactly the kind of practice they want, to have the opportunity to work for a faith-based organization can be a wonderful foundation to build a practice off of. It certainly worked for me. And having that that kindred, that relationship with the organization that I served for, was something that really inspired a lot of trust and confidence in me and in that in my organization. So that when we did face challenging times, when there were directives that maybe I didn't understand, I also had faith that I understood where the organization came from and was intending to go. And so that foundation, that support, that alignment was very important to me and helped me to kind of shape my philosophy that wanted to embrace my peers and help them see that same foundation with whatever organization they work for. We talked about this before. You don't have to work for a faith-based organization. You don't have to work for a for-profit or not-for-profit. There is outstanding patient care being delivered by all healthcare entities every day. But you need to have faith and confidence in your organization that they're headed in a similar direction you are in order to join forces with them and really affect change beyond your own practice.
Very good. So one of the themes that I've seen among successful healthcare leaders is the ability to bring physicians, administrators, and boards together around a common vision. So how did you approach physician engagement and alignment during your years as an executive?
Well, it goes back to when I first started out. I really found myself frustrated early on that I just didn't understand how healthcare worked. I really thought I was just going to come out and take care of patients. Else would just fall into place. And the reality was, as you and all of our colleagues can attest to, it probably hasn't been that simple for 100 years. And as I would bump up against certain frustrations that interfere with me taking care of my patient, I recognized the need for the physician voice to be at the table. I very quickly learned from my peers that struggle with the same things or similar things to what I was struggling with. And I feel like we're not being heard. And when you see surveys from physicians, that's one of the top three complaints. The administrative team doesn't listen to me. I'm not heard. I'm not involved in decision-making. Those are I bet that's a top five on every physician survey at every.
I'm sure. Yeah.
And it's not that administrators aren't listening. In fact, I found the opposite. When I started to engage with administration and really kind of step back to look at the relationship, not just from my perspective, but from a more holistic or community perspective, I recognize that administrators were desperate for the clinical voice. And think about the resources that are invested in that physician survey. Low margin companies don't invest anything without the intent to have a benefit from it. And so these organizations, healthcare organizations, are spending an incredible amount of resources, time, money to understand what the clinician is saying. I believe the fault that clinicians own is we come back to administration with just a cacophony. There are so many different voices, different perspectives, that it is impossible to find the one that really matters. That's what encouraged me. My peers were complaining about not being heard. The managers, leaders of the organization wanted to hear the physician voice, and that encouraged me to try to unify that voice. It led to some sort of consensus where administration could confidently pursue whatever that consensus voice was encouraging to, and then whether it succeeded or failed, at least have the confidence that they had the support of physicians. I saw that work many times early on in my career, and that really engaged and encouraged me to pursue that idea further.
Yeah. Well, I know as an administrator, and you're exactly right, I always wanted to hear what the physician said. And wanted to, because the physicians also had the organization's interests in, best interests, in mind as well, for the betterment of their patients. The problem from an administrative side, I'm glad to hear what you were saying, is that it wasn't just one or two physicians, say in cardiology. It was cardiology, it was urology, it was orthopedics, it was all of the subspecialists. And at times there were competing issues there that then as an administrator, you had to look to your physician leadership, your chief medical officer or medical staff president and say, okay, what do you feel is the true priority here? you know, and balancing that with the organization's priority of, hey, we're going to advance cardiac care, or we're going to be the top-notch joint replacement facility or whatever. So hearing a physician, you know, the physician willingness to help with that prioritization is huge and frankly welcomed. So with all of this, the Clinical Network Collaborative has come about. Tell me about that. Tell me about your mission as far as that goes.
Yeah. Well, thank you for asking. To me, I was very deliberate about the naming. Clinical, I wanted it to be about clinicians. I believe the power in clinicians to, if not create, represent the network that we operate in. Our practices exist within a network, whether we realize it or not. Right? And so having that clinical voice align with the work we participate in and do it in a collaborative way, that's the intention behind the name, is to help clinicians understand that we are part of a network and that it is in our own individual practice's best interest to collaborate and make the network that supports our practice as successful as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in a constrained environment today, have been for 20, 30 years. Back to your earlier point, when margins were consistently 20 to 40%, and there are still organizations that live in reality today, it's easy. It's fairly easy to satisfy everybody. That's more than enough for just about every opportunity we can interest ourselves in. That's easy to lead that. When we're talking about single digit margins, that's when we need a unified voice to really understand that we're pursuing what our organization thinks is in its best needs. And Kevin, also, just if I can go on a little bit more, physicians always talk about my practice. You know, my practice is important to me, and that's entirely factual. I mean, there's no denying that. I've challenged my peers when they come back with that. Well, that doesn't work for my practice. Well, now hang on a second. Let's talk about Kevin, the administrator. What's in his best interest? His best interest is to see your practice be successful, because he is managing the network that our practice exists in. So let's sit down with Kevin and his team and let's figure out how we make the network as successful as possible, because that will benefit our practice. So it's in Kevin's best interest to see my practice be successful in our network. And it's a very simple thing that a lot of physicians don't always see that. In fact, I would challenge you that a majority of independent-minded physicians see administrative colleagues as combatants, as the other side, as a suit. And I felt like it was an opportunity for me to say, hang on a second, Kevin does better when your practice does better.
And I was going to say, the independent practices don't understand that as administrator, you're exactly right. I want them to succeed because I don't want to have to come in and prop them up or purchase them. I mean, you're not on my balance sheet if you're successful in your independent practice. So I'm going to do everything I can to help.
And instead, we've developed this transactional relationship where we feel like we're competing all the time. And not that there's anything wrong with a transaction. I mean, let's face it, that's how business has been done and will continue to be in perpetuity. What I'm suggesting is because healthcare has gotten to be maybe unsustainable. I don't know what the right word is.
So you've touched on it a little bit, David, but why is clinical integration and collaboration more important today than ever?
We have made healthcare overly complex, and we've just continued to add services, add opportunities to treat patients, because that's the business we're in. I really think we need to take a step back and try to simplify healthcare. I think it'd be more cost effective. You know, where there are duplication of services, we need to ask ourselves, do we really need to duplicate services? There's just not enough resources to go around to duplicate services within the same network. Now, you and I both can put out plenty of good examples of why we need to duplicate or triplicate any number of services, but I feel like we spend too much on waste. And I think if clinicians and network administrators, and I'm purposeful there because it's not just hospitals, it's not just health systems, It's not just third-party payer systems who are now employing more physicians than even health systems are. It's all of the above. And they're all trying to create a network from their assets that's as efficient as possible to manage the constrained resources that we have available to us. We need clinicians to help guide us on what services we should invest in and or divest in. And then we need to partner with our administrative colleagues to pursue those strategies as successfully as we can.
So from your perspective, what are the biggest opportunities for clinically integrated networks, independent physician groups, and community-based healthcare organizations over the next 5 years?
You know, so that's actually a fairly easy response. We touched on it with the last that the opportunity is to help direct healthcare resources. Mm-hmm. The days of, you know, having a, you know, every physician that came into your office, no, not every physician, many physicians who sought you out in your office was confident that either you or your CFO was sitting on a hoard of cash and could dig into that secret stash of cash at any moment and pay for whatever it is I thought you needed to pay for. If those days ever existed, they've not existed in my career, my 30 plus year career. Those days are gone. And so we now need to take that finite resource and really help direct it. And here's the hard part. This is where, you know, it's what we've talked about so far. And sometimes when I read clinical network collaborative, I think, well, that's obvious. Here's where the hard part comes in. All of the stakeholders in healthcare, all the various administrative specialties and all the clinical specialties need to identify the stakeholders, get a reasonable, respected, representative number of them in a room. And I think what we focus on is patient care and the communities that those issues exist. That to me is the North Star that most everyone in healthcare can agree that, yeah, that's really what we should be pursuing. I believe if we do that right and provide, you know, it's the old adage, right patient, right place, right treatment, right time. If we let that be our focus, everyone else will benefit. There's so much waste in healthcare today that if we can focus on patient care, optimizing patient care first, that we can eliminate waste and there we can go back to a time of plenty and really do strategies that we think are in the best interest of the business. But if we don't do that, I worry that the controllers of the healthcare dollar, which is largely employers and the government, and again, I have nothing but love. They have filled an unenviable role for 50 to 100 years, depending upon the entity. They have fulfilled a critically important role, but at this point in time, during transformational change, they're transactional, and we need transformation. And I think clinicians and our managers need to work together to solve that.
So what advice would you give today's healthcare leaders about building sustainable partnerships versus a transactional type relationship?
And to be sure, we continue to do both. We will continue to have contracts and trans that are critically important, but we do need to start building this transformative capability. And, you know, to me, it's really as simple as building relationships. I think it has become very easy for physicians to demonize administrators. And I think it's been maybe equally easy for administrators, pure administrators, to demonize clinicians. And we need to take a step back and show each other some mercy grace, recognize that we're all attacking similar problems for the same goal, taking care of patients in our community, and build relationships that are based upon trust. And let's face it, I can learn to trust a complete stranger. You don't have to be my best friend. You don't have to be my my pledge brother's little brother to have trust. Those things may help. They also may hurt. But building a trustful relationship, you can do that with anybody. And it's as simple as, you know, doing the things that you said you're going to do. Meet the person in their place of business. You know, handshake rounds. These are some simple relationship building techniques. But both parties need to be open to it. Both parties need to be receptive. We need to put past differences aside and be willing to embrace one another to face the challenges ahead of us. This is one of those situations where we either fix it or the fix will be provided for us. And I'm not trying to speak badly about employers or the government, but I don't trust them to fix the clinical problems in healthcare. I trust physicians and clinicians and our manager partners more to solve these problems than huge government or employer entities.
No, I would agree with that. Okay, last question. You've spent your career watching healthcare trends come and go. So what's something that healthcare leaders spend way too much time worrying about that you simply don't care about anymore? And what should they focus on instead?
I think it's a good one. And you're right. There's a lot of things that we spin our wheels on. Let's just name one. I think one of the things that we spin our wheels on too much is the electronic medical record and whether or not it even exists. If you're on a medical record today, I hate to break it to you, it's not your last medical record. It'll either get an upgrade and the upgrade will be so different from the last version that you're essentially learning a new software product, or Epic, if you're not on Epic, you're going to be on Epic eventually because it's going to consume everybody. That's an inside joke, but fighting the medical record is, a waste of time and effort. And instead, we need to recognize that there are benefits to having a medical record, owning a medical record, and we need to work together to optimize the medical record. And we don't change the EMR, electronic medical record. We don't change to fit us. We have to adapt. It's a new infrastructure. It's a new highway system. We don't drive on the same old roads if we've invented created new roads to get us to our destination. It may be a different route. Not be comfortable with it, but if it's a better road and it's the road that most of us are on, we need to take the better road. So quit fighting electronic medical record, embrace them, and leverage them to make your practice better. That's something that I comes up over and over again. When are we going to get rid of the EMR? When are we going to get better EMR?
So how can my audience, number one, learn more about the Clinical Network Collaborative and also contact you, David?
Well, I have my contact information on my website. So it's clinicalnetworkcollaborative.com, spelled out, special characters, unique characters, all one word, no spaces, clinicalnetworkcollaborative.com. And then I've started writing a Substack. I've started just these same kind of conversations. I'm asking myself a question, or I'm seeing an article come up. You wrote a particularly good article recently that I've already commented on. I'm going to pull that. Yeah, I'm going to pull that into my LinkedIn feed. I'm going to reference it and have a little comment there to my audience. So whether I'm on LinkedIn or Substack or Clinical Network Collaborative, please feel free to look me up.
Sounds great. David, this has been so much fun. I've really enjoyed this. It's been great catching up with you and getting your perspective, not only on healthcare in the Arkansas market, but really throughout the country. So thanks again for joining me.
Kevin, I can't thank you enough. It's great to see you again, and look forward to future conversations and seeing what you do with your life. I'm incredibly impressed with what you do.
Well, thanks for that. Well, folks, it's Dr. David Foster. Obviously, connect with him on clinicalnetworkcollaborative.com, LinkedIn, Substack. He's the one that turned me on to Substack. I didn't even know what it was. So, David, thanks for that. One more social media for me to play with. But with that, I appreciate you joining me as always here on I Don't Care with Dr. Kevin Stevenson. I know you could find other ways to spend your time, and for you to spend time with me and my guests means an awful lot. So with that, take care, and we will talk again next week. Bye.